/grad. And that familiar melody, of course, is Auld Lang Syne, and the musicians playing it, the Kenosha Pops Band, under the direction of Craig Gall. The Kenosha Pops Band, of course, is a real hallmark here in southeastern Wisconsin, and many, many hundreds of people, week after week through much of the summer, find their way to Penoyer Park on the north side of Kenosha to enjoy the Wednesday night Lakeside Pops concerts of the Kenosha Pops Band. And I'm really, really excited to have Craig Gall with me, who is the music director of the Kenosha Pops Band. And how long has it been that you have been at the helm?
This is my 14th season as conductor, although I served 7 years prior to that as Frank Germanaro's assistant director. And I joined the band back in 1992, I believe.
Wow.
John Bunick asked me to play a little baritone, and just kind of was a succession of events. And
wow. So next year is going to be your 25th anniversary of being some part of the band then.
You would have to bring that up.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a good thing. It's
yeah.
been a really great relationship and lots of fun over those 20, 24, 25 years.
Great. Well, let's talk first of all about this upcoming season and maybe talk a little bit about how these seasons get put together by you and your able assistant conductor, Garrett Kornman.
Right, Garrett Kornman is my assistant director, and Garrett and I have known each other since my teaching days here in Kenosha, which started back in 1990. He assisted me with some of the summer band duties that I had through the Kenosha School District Continental Band and Rambler Band. And when I took over as director 14 years ago, he was my go-to guy as far as, you know, who's going to be my assistant director. And it's been just a really great working relationship for the last 14 years. Garrett and I get together, usually in April for a weekend, and we sit down and kind of decide what we're going to be doing for the following summer, because our librarian really likes to have the list of music in advance so she can get the folders stuffed, and that is no small job, believe me. I'm not sure. We usually play something like 120 different tunes every year. And a lot of those stay in the folder from season to season, but a lot don't, depending on the themes we pick for each of the weekly concerts.
Right.
And some of those themes our yearly themes. We can't get away from the patriotic stuff around the 4th of July. We always try to do some sort of Broadway or movie night every year. We also try to do something totally unique, something we haven't tried before, and that's usually driven by some of the music that we see in the library that might not have been out for years. Or in this case, this year, we found a song on one of the music sites that we look for is for purchasing music. It was a medley of music written for the NFL football films.
Ah.
And we thought, well, what could we do here, and we came up with an entire evening of sports music or sports-associated music. And that's going to be one of the last concerts of the summer. We're also doing a salute to the Olympics that evening, tied in quite nicely. So we're doing some of the things John Williams has written for of the Olympics over the many years. And so a brand new theme was born for this summer.
Wow. And so just from a intriguing piece of music and its title, a whole program can be born, or you hope so anyway.
Hope so.
Right.
Sometimes we make a pretty big stretch. we've made several programming decisions that could turn a few heads and say, how in the world did they ever decide to put that on this? Exactly. But we usually come up with a good excuse, and then that usually satisfies folks. But
and the rest is history.
You bet.
One of the things that I think would be interesting to talk about before we find out about some of the specific themes is what do you think about in terms of achieving a balance between sort of pleasing the masses, entertaining the masses, versus also playing music that is really high quality and at least once in a while in a given evening, maybe challenging the audience in the sense of playing something that is a piece of music that has real substance versus a little less just kind of razzle-dazzle or familiar appeal. Do you consciously think about that very much?
We do, but Garrett and I firmly feel that our philosophy is that we are a community band, and we're there to entertain the community. So that's first and foremost our biggest concern. We also want to play a variety of music, and we're careful what we pick. The music we play certainly has to challenge our players. We don't want our musicians in the band to be bored, and we don't want to aim too low either and play schlock, if I can use that word.
Yeah.
So we do want the music to have substance. We do want musical integrity in our programs, but what we try to do is program enough variety to satisfy the tastes of everyone, not only in the audience, but also in the band as well. We have several soloists in the band that we like to feature from time to time, some very wonderful talent in that group that you know would be a shame to go to waste if we didn't feature them from time to time. You know, from time to time throughout the summer we'll play semi-classical selections. In fact, we wanted to program more music of this variety, so we decided to start the indoor concerts. And we do those every 2 or 3 years. We'll do an indoor summer concert, which is unusual for us because we're usually down at the Bandshell on Pennoyer Park. I don't know, 8-10 years ago, Garrett decided, why don't we try an indoor concert to see if some of this more substantial old chestnut band literature would fly with our audience. And it's been enormously successful. We do those, as I said, every 2 or 3 seasons we'll try and get into Carthage, and it works out real well. So we try to strike that balance. Mm-hmm. And finding music every year that fits that bill is not always easy. Sometimes we'll only purchase 4 or 5 new pieces of music that we think is going to fit our programming needs. Mm-hmm. This year we purchased almost 20 pieces of new music for this summer season that we thought was really going to fit in well and would really be a nice match for the band and for the audience. So
we should maybe remind people that every time somebody purchases one of the compact disc recordings of the band, my understanding is that at least that money, by and large at least, goes towards that library fund.
Towards the library fund, towards new equipment if we need it. But mostly for purchasing new music, yes.
Very good. Well, let's take this upcoming season apart. And by the time people hear this conversation, the Kenosha Band will have already played one concert downtown on Saturday afternoon, the 11th of June. And that's become something of a new tradition as well, that actually, I think the first time the band actually plays in the summer is that Saturday afternoon gig down at the museum. How did that begin?
Well, by contract with the city of Kenosha, we are sponsored by the city of Kenosha. They have an option concert that they can ask us to play anywhere, anytime. And over the past, oh my goodness, 10 or more years now, that concert has been the Civil War Museum, and it always tends to be about a week before our official summer season of Wednesday night concerts begins. And it's not a terribly labor-intensive concert. We play a lot of the old things that the band is familiar with. We've only had two rehearsals under our belt so far, and sometimes less for that concert, unfortunately. So we rely on old standard marches and patriotic things and a few Civil War things to tie the whole idea of the Civil War Museum into the concert. But that concert is a request from the city of Kenosha every year.
And then, of course, people are hearing this interview Tuesday morning, so tomorrow night, Wednesday night, we'll kick off a series of Wednesday night concerts. And for the most part, at least, each and every week, the band is rehearsing once all of that music, which is part of the concert coming up two nights later.
That is essentially correct. We have two rehearsals before the season actually begins, and that those are designated for some of the music we haven't played in years that we want to run the band through and see if it's actually going to work. Hmm. As I mentioned, we purchased 20 new pieces of music this summer, and we ran a lot of those in our first two rehearsals as well. But each of the concerts, we rehearse, concerts are on Wednesday nights, and the rehearsals are on Monday nights for 2 hours. And basically everything for that Wednesday night concerts is run in rehearsal on that Monday night. And if there's anything that really proves to be troublesome, we'll re-rehearse those areas and try and get things fixed up. But other than a read-through and a little bit of touching up, that's about all the rehearsal those concerts get each week.
Wow. Which says a lot about the quality of the men and women who are on that stage, who are in this group.
Absolutely. We are so very fortunate, Garrett and I, to be able to put a piece of music in front of the group, run through it real quickly, and touch it up if we need to, and move on to the very next thing. And that couldn't happen if we didn't have really strong players in the group.
Right. I suppose this is also a matter that you have to think about a bit when you are putting a given concert together, that you can look at a score and at least to a rough extent have some sense of, this is a killer. This is really, really hard. This is really, really tricky. And you don't want to load up a concert with three or four of those kind of pieces.
Right, right. I mean, one or two pieces like that on a concert, you know, is probably enough. Because something like that will take quite a bit of rehearsal time to put together. And, you know, when we are playing a 90-minute concert and we only have 2 hours to rehearse for it, we have to be very, very, very careful about what we program and make sure that there's enough, I don't want to use the word easy stuff, let's say accessible music for the band, and maybe one or two challenging things that our musicians can chew on a little bit give them a bit of a challenge.
Right. Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today in this portion of the morning show with Craig Gall, who is, I'm calling you the music director of the Kenosha Pops Band. Is that right? Is that your official title?
That's right.
Okay.
Musical director and conductor, I guess, is what the official position is.
He does wave his arms in front of this group. I don't know how much they watch him, but he waves his arms. And, of course, many of you enjoy these Wednesday night concerts during a good portion of the summer. These concerts Wednesday night at Penoyer Park on the, I still call it the sesquicentennial band shell, because it was built to honor the city's sesquicentennial.
Correct, yes.
And these concerts are free and open to the public, and it's the city of Kenosha and a number of different sponsors that that make these concerts possible. So, Craig, we've already talked a little bit about how you and Garrett put your heads together and construct a season of repertoire for the Kenosha Pops Band. So talk us through this season, beginning with the concert that's coming up tomorrow night.
Coming up on Wednesday, June 15th, we are doing a Broadway night. Being the first concert of the summer, we're calling it Curtain Up.
Hmm.
and lots of old Broadway favorites. We're looking at 76 trombones from The Music Man in a wonderful arrangement by Leroy Anderson, who was for a long time the composer in residence for the Boston Pops,
right,
of course, with Arthur Fiedler. And, well, there's a whole show on Anderson by itself, I'm sure, but he wrote so many neat things that for the Boston Pops that he later, most of them, would reorchestrate for band because the band arrangements sold more quickly than the orchestra arrangements because there were more community bands in the country at the time than orchestras. So Leroy Anderson is always a staple for us on many, many concerts throughout the summer. In addition to 76 trombones, we're going to have a couple of Gershwin things sung by Lou Rugani on that concert, But Not For Me and Someone to Watch Over Me. Highlights from Fiddler on the Roof will be played that evening. Some highlights from Funny Girl. All kinds of neat things. Several medleys of familiar Broadway things. And a brand new arrangement for concert band of highlights from The King and I. It's based very closely on the original Broadway orchestral overture.
Oh, wonderful.
And so this is a brand new piece for us, I think very recently published within the last year, actually.
Very good.
So we're excited about that.
And a lot of people listening will know the name Bob Benson, who they have seen do all kinds of exciting things with the Racine Theater Guild, and he'll be stepping in for me since I have to be out of town, and we'll be singing Gershwin's I Got Plenty of Nothing, which I think will be a very exciting high point.
Very excited. It's a great arrangement and, of course, just a timeless tune.
Absolutely.
From a great, great musical.
So that's opera. Opera.
Opera.
As an opera fan, I have to make sure everybody calls Porgy and Bess an opera. And then a week from tomorrow night is concert number two. And what's that going to be?
That is our rock and roll concert. And we don't do a rock and roll concert every year. And the years we don't do a rock and roll concert, I hear about it.
Ah, okay.
So and from not only audience members, but from the band. Obviously, we can't do a rock and roll concert every year, although people would like to. I mean, we still like to mix the programming up a little bit from year to year. And we usually save a rock concert for every couple of years. So we're going to be doing medley of hits from the rock group Chicago. We're going to be doing some highlights of career hits from Sonny and Cher. A real nice arrangement of songs written by Jim Croce. Some things by the Carpenters. Some Motown hits. We're even going to have the audience sing along on Sweet Caroline. Just a fun concert of rock and roll favorites that's sure to entertain the young and the old.
Wow. Sounds like a fun, fun night. So what's concert number three? Does that bring us into July yet?
No, that's June 29th.
Oh, yeah.
We're getting close to the 4th of July. That concert is entitled Pops Out West. So this is going to be a concert of all kinds of music associated with the Wild West or anything to do with Out West. Again, we'll program anything as long as it has something to do with the West. The theme from the great movie The Magnificent Seven.
Oh, love it.
Streets of Laredo. Highlights from Dances with Wolves. Some new things we bought this year are an arrangement of the theme music from the Grand Canyon movie, which I am unfamiliar with. It's like a 20-year-old movie, but a real nice arrangement. We also finally got our hands on the musical highlights from Paint Your Wagon. We actually tapped into a university in North Dakota for this music, and I've been looking for this music for years. So we're excited to share that with our audiences for the first time. Ferdy Groffé's on the Trail, a little snippet from the William Tell Overture to pull the Lone Ranger into things. So it should be a really fun concert and a real novelty number that we found that was John Philip Sousa's favorite encore piece, something called The Roosters Lay Eggs in Kansas.
Oh, my gosh.
Which calls for group vocals, and the band's going to be singing, and little soloists throughout. It's going to be a very, very, very fun concert.
Fantastic.
So that's the Pops Out West on June 29th.
Great. Now we start getting into July, and of course we start getting close to the 4th of July.
Well, in fact, the 4th of July lands on a Monday this year, which is our rehearsal night, which is proving to be a little bit of a problem. We're actually scheduling a separate rehearsal from Monday night, a Thursday night rehearsal to rehearse for the 4th of July. And if people do not want to join us in Wolfenbüttel Park on July 4th, which is the only concert, incidentally, that we do not play in Pinoyer Park.
Right.
They can hear essentially the same concert in Pinoyer Park 2 days later on July 6th. And that, of course, is everything and anything patriotic. Sousa marches, real nice arrangements of American folk songs, and just a concert of Americana.
Wonderful.
And the big treat that evening is our 20-minute March Marathon.
Oh, yeah.
That pays tribute to all five branches of the armed forces. We play all of the concert versions in succession with street beats in between of the official marches of the armed forces. And we end with the Star-Spangled Banner. It's a very, I think, moving tribute to all of our veterans. Of course, they stand up and are recognized while their song is being played, and just a real nice touch to the 4th of July proceedings.
Absolutely. July 13th?
Lights, Camera, Pops. That's our movie night. So all kinds of neat music from the movies. The Way We Were, the theme from Lawrence of Arabia. You're going to be singing the song from Moulin Rouge, old movie about Toulouse-Lautrec and all the crazy things that were going on at that time in France. You're also going to be singing a little ditty from The Wizard of Oz that evening called Over the Rainbow.
Really? Okay.
And yeah, he's just finding this out now. Greg, as you know, we should mention you are our MC and our vocalist.
I do enjoy this gig. It's one of my favorite things to do. And that sounds like it's going to be a fun night.
And I need to point out two special pieces that are brand new for that concert. Highlights from The Great Race, which is a very fun movie from the late 60s.
Tony Curtis, I remember.
Yes,
and Jack Lemmon.
Great music by Henry Mancini.
Yep.
And a brand new arrangement of music from the James Bond films.
Oh, cool.
So that should be a lot of fun.
Great. July 20th?
Oriental Excursions. An entire evening of music from the Orient, which would seem like a very difficult concert to program, but we've actually come up with a real nice selection of music for that evening, including a brand new orchestrated piece for band of a unknown piece by George Gershwin called Japanese. It's very short, but very, very, very nice and very listenable, and all kinds of other music of music associated with the Orient, including highlights from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Flower Drum Song.
Oh, we don't hear enough from that wonderful show.
Yes.
Great idea. Cool. Well, let's talk quickly about the last two concerts. So it's the July 27th.
July 27th is our Sporting Life concert, which brings all of those sports themes together. We'll be playing the Olympic Fanfare and Theme, which was written for the 1984 Olympics,
right.
I believe, in Los Angeles. We're going to also be playing John Williams' Olympic Spirit, which was commissioned by the NBC Network as theme music for them. In addition, we'll be playing this medley of NFL sports films music. We've got our hands on the arrangement of the Green Bay Packer fight song, which will be making its first appearance on a Kenosha concert. All kinds of neat sports-related things. The Parade of the Charioteers from Ben-Hur, and also the National Game March, written by John Philip Sousa for the National Baseball League. So, and our final concert of the summer, the first week of August, is simply a concert of encores of some of our favorite pieces that went over very well throughout the course of the summer.
Favorite moments from the whole night. So it all gets going tomorrow night at Pinoyer Park. It's, of course, free, open to the public. There is some seating available, but otherwise people are encouraged to bring their own lawn chairs or blankets, if you like. And otherwise,
especially jackets, that can get a little cool along the lake, especially for these early concerts.
Absolutely. But come on out to Pinoyer Park and enjoy wonderful night of music making with the Kenosha Pops Band under the direction of their two directors, Gert Kornman and Craig Gall. Craig Gall, great to catch up with you, and it sounds like an exciting summer. I'm excited to be a small part of it, and we hope a lot of people will have it marked on their calendars. So.
Thanks for having me.
The time is 8:35. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Greg Reberg. Here's part two of today's program. Right up the road from us on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, yet another Fresh Ink Festival has been taking place under the auspices of the Fifth House Ensemble, a Chicago-based musical organization that does such brilliant, innovative things. And any of you who listen to The Morning Show on a regular basis surely know something about Fifth House. We've talked with them before and talked about some of the exciting things that they have done. And I'm very excited to have with me in the studios Melissa Snoza, who is executive director of the Fifth House Ensemble and their flutist, here to talk about this year's Fresh Ink Festival and a couple of opportunities that you have to take in some of what is going on with this year's Fresh Ink Festival. Melissa Snoza, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
It's so good to talk to you. And, of course, it's always fun to talk about Fifth House Ensemble. For the sake of anybody who might be listening who actually doesn't know who or what Fifth House Ensemble is, we better begin there.
Absolutely. Well, we are a mixed instrumentation, large chamber music group, meaning that we have several different kinds of instruments. We have one of each string instrument, violin, viola, bass, and cello. We also have a woodwind quintet and a piano in our ensemble. And we formed 10 years ago. It's actually the end of our 10th season now.
So we have two anniversaries to celebrate.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing that we looked at each other and said when we were in that first meeting together is, you know, it's our job to help people remember why they love music. So let's find the many different ways that we can do that. So today what that looks like, we have a series of concerts that we do in Chicago, which is sort of our playground for playing around with new ideas. Everything from collaborating with the Mediterranean Folk Band to doing the first ever interactive concert version of a video game with live video game players, to doing projects with graphic novelists. That's our way of, you know, playing around with what we can do in live performance. We also have done education work in K-12 schools since the very beginning. And we focus on arts integration, so the idea that you can teach music alongside core curricular subjects. Mm. And then finally, we do a lot of work in entrepreneurship for emerging artists. So we visit the nation's top music schools and conservatories every year, especially as they're in these moments where they're reframing the way that they do curriculum for emerging musicians. And so a lot of what we offer is the basics of how to establish your career as a musician and how to form a business, market yourself, handle fundraising. But we also do a lot with how to engage different communities in the music making process, whether it's adults or kids in the classroom.
Mm. Explain the name.
Fifth House Ensemble is, I get asked that a lot. And it's so funny because the fifth house in astrology is the house of creativity and pleasure and the arts. And when we were conceiving of the name, the one thing that I wanted out of this was to have real words in the name as opposed to something that I had to spell out. The irony is that no one can understand the word fifth over the phone, so I have to spell it out every time.
Well, what an intriguing name. Now, for those of you that got together, did you already have, in a sense, more kind of standard musical gigs that operated, occupied some of your time, but in a sense sort of felt this hunger to do something a little more interesting as well on top of it? Or, I mean, just in a sense, what sort of void was this filling for those of you that gathered for that first time 10 years ago?
Great question. for many of us, we had just come out of the Civic Orchestra of Chicago. So what we were doing with most of our time was playing standard orchestral repertoire on a beautiful stage with great conductors. And there's, for a musician, oftentimes nothing more satisfying than that. And yet we also were participating in a program called Music Corps through the Civic Orchestra, which sent you out to Indian Boundary Park or to a school or to a youth orchestra to either teach or play a chamber music concert. And what many of us realized was that the decisions we made had a profound impact as to how our audience engaged with us. Whether you saw the light bulb go off or whether they were taking the most expensive nap of their lives, like that was, those were decisions we were making in advance, and those were directly related to how we were engaging with people from the stage through our instruments and also through speaking and how we contextualize what we chose to do. So for many of us, this was an opportunity to play around with those ideas and desires, to really think about the fact that, you know, when you're playing in an orchestra, it's a wonderful thing. And I'm never going to say that it's not a valid and beautiful way to experience music. But as an individual musician, you have less choice in that scenario. And these are people who really wanted to get their hands dirty and play around.
I know that in particular, one of the things, and you've touched on it already, that one of the things you've enjoyed doing is not only doing some unconventional things, but also making music in unconventional places. And I suppose in some ways that's even a simpler thing to accomplish. And yet that probably has posed some really intriguing challenges over the years and some real delights, too.
Absolutely. I mean, we've played everywhere from train stations to bars to restaurants to libraries to aquariums. And, you know, I think one of the more interesting projects that we did this last year was that video game project, which we ran a Kickstarter campaign for with a modest goal of $5,000. We hit that goal within 2 hours. And by the end, we had raised $52,000 from over 1,200 backers around the world. And we premiered that at the Music and Gaming Festival in the D.C. area, which attracts 27,000 video game enthusiasts every year. And it's the most amazing place to people watch. I mean, people come in costume. Like, there's so many amazing things that happen there. But we had 2,500 people in the audience sitting cross-legged on a ballroom floor, completely wrapped. I mean, it's amazing what happens. And many of them are not the sort who would typically come to a chamber music concert, but afterwards were like, that was one of the best performance experiences I've ever had.
Wow. We're speaking with Melissa Snoza, who is executive director and flutist for the Fifth House Ensemble, based in Chicago, although in some ways it seems folly to say based in Chicago. That just, in a sense, although that is exactly where you're based, but I mean, what you do has such, in a sense, far-reaching effects, and you've reached out in all kinds of exciting ways. And one of the ways over the last 5 years has been with the creation of this thing called the Fresh Ink Festival, which has taken place on the University of Wisconsin Parkside. First of all, explain who this was conceived for.
Great question. We, as people who had just come out of music school when we started Fifth House Ensemble, didn't know almost anything that we needed to know in order to start a new business. And I will say this with the full understanding that I went through one of the nation's first arts leadership programs. So I went through the Eastman School of Music and the arts leadership program, and I got a fantastic education in how to be an administrator at that time. And I will say, I'll put an asterisk here and say that that program has developed significantly over the last 15 years to the point where many of the things that I'm talking about here have started to be resolved. But at that time, I didn't know how to start my own business, but I did know how to function within an existing organization. So when it came time for us to start a new venture, for me to sit on the floor of Borders when that existed with a stack of books, learning how to start a nonprofit, learning how to start an LLC, what are my different business structure choices? You know, how do I handle our tax return? How do I write an effective grant? I mean, this was basically a curriculum I set up for myself by researching online, by researching books and resources, and by having a pretty extensive coffee fund where I would just pay for coffee with people who had done aspects of what I was looking to do. And I wanted to shortcut that process for other people because I think that at this point, musicians are really getting clued into the fact that they have the option to do many different kinds of things and that some of those are incredibly fulfilling and creative. And it's it behooves them to understand what that's going to mean for them in terms of actually making a living off of the things that they dream about doing.
Right. Well, and as you describe a scenario in which somebody has not been told any of that and has to sort of figure it out completely on their own, I mean, somebody might hear that and think, oh, well, maybe that's the best way to learn is just figuring it out and making mistakes. But when you think about making really costly mistakes and making mistakes that lead to dead ends and slow you down and maybe even lead you to be so discouraged that you just jettison the whole thing. I mean, maybe on paper it sounds like making mistakes, learning as you go is not the worst thing in the world. When it comes to actually building a career and making something happen, it's terrible to saddle somebody with that kind of ignorance that they have to sort of make their way through. So you're probably doing an enormous service to young musicians who otherwise would be, in a sense, left to fend for themselves to a large extent.
Well, thanks. And, you know, to be honest, I don't mind that people make mistakes on the creative side. I want them to take
right.
risks and fail early, fail often, and fail cheaply, you know, so that they understand who they are and what they want to do. But the thing that I want to avoid is that they don't know how to file the appropriate forms or they don't know what's the right business structure, because these things are pretty... I mean, the information's out there, and it just doesn't happen to be in most music schools.
Right. And so you set up this framework then by which then they can be alive, innovative artists and take chances and do all kinds of things and occasionally fail, maybe often fail, but you're not failing in those kind of nitty-gritty matters that are really, really important. And like you say, that tend not to be shared in the typical music curriculum.
Precisely.
And I suppose maybe at the risk of generalizing, there's plenty of musicians, I'm one of them, for whom that kind of thing is also not going to be a natural bent. I mean, there's a lot of us who, as creative people, also fall into that stereotype of not being particularly good with paperwork or forms. We don't have, that's not where our natural instincts lie, and so for a musician like that, it's especially important.
Absolutely. And, you know, the way that I think of this, not every musician should be a person like me that wears both hats. And I think people get confused on that sometimes, that they think that's my expectation. You know, if everyone in Fifth House Ensemble was exactly like me, we would never get anything done. We'd be infighting all the time. You know, so if you happen to be a person who doesn't particularly feel attracted to the administrative side, then simply attach yourself to someone who is, right? That's what teamwork and collaboration are all about. There's nothing wrong with that. And I would venture to say that the majority of musicians aren't necessarily people who are the most comfortable with Excel spreadsheets, right?
Right, right.
So that's all good and well. But the thing that's great is that if you understand what those things do and what they mean, then you'll understand when they're being done well, and you'll also be able to recognize what the perhaps financial implications of your artistic decisions might be, so that when you're having that conversation, it's not like two people talking from opposite ends of a table.
Absolutely. One of my recollections in being on the board of directors of the Kenosha Symphony for many, many years was sometimes, without naming any names, how difficult a situation could be if you had, for instance, a conductor sitting on this side of the table with certain artistic or musical vision, and then people on the other side who are really interested in ledgers and budgets and bottom lines and so on. And, of course, both those things are really important, and one can't exist without the other. But I remember so many times when it felt like we were talking two different languages, and probably part of what you're doing is equipping musicians, in a sense, to be a little more fluent in some of that other language that otherwise, you know, might not be a part of who they are.
That's 100% true. And little known fact, the last professional orchestra service that I did as a regular member of an orchestra was to walk a picket line. They were going on strike at that moment, and never was it more real to me how important an understanding of those things is, both to be able to understand when management was actually doing something that was in the best interest of musicians but didn't seem that way in the short term, or when they really weren't. So without that understanding, it's difficult to make that judgment call. But, you know, one of the things that's really special about Fifth House and the way we run the business side of things is that it's probably one of the more democratic scenarios that exists. We actually make our financial decisions together in full view of musicians and getting their feedback and all of these things. We do all of our artistic planning together. And while there are staff individuals and also a board who are ultimately responsible for making sure that those decisions move forward, there is a significant amount of transparency and also feedback and participation from all of the artists in our group, which, you know, allows for there to be ownership when there are decisions that don't go the way that we want them to go. Mm-hmm. We at least can look at each other and say, cool, so we did this together. Let's figure out what we're going to do now together.
Yeah, to repair this decision we maybe shouldn't have made together. But yes, we're talking with Melissa Snoza, who is Executive Director of Fifth House Ensemble. So describe what's been happening on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside with this fifth annual Fresh Ink. I mean, on sort of a day-to-day basis, what have you been doing with these young musicians?
Absolutely. So we have 16 composers who are joining us this year. Hmm. We also have instrumentalists and ensembles coming from all over the country, everyone up to the age of 32. And one of the main purposes of the festival is for us to rehearse and premiere 16 new works of chamber music that are written for this two-week experience. So those happen over two final concerts at the very end of the festival. Hmm. But we're also rehearsing existing works of music, everything from earlier music all the way up to music that's being written right now. And then there's a series of concerts. So we play something like 10 concerts over these 14 days, everything from salon concerts that take place at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside to performances at the Racine and Kenosha Public Libraries. There are educational concerts at the Racine YMCA. We played at the Milwaukee Art Museum on Wednesday. So there are a lot of different contexts for which musicians can start to play with how they engage with the public. And it all goes with that idea that we can talk about these things in a classroom in lecture format, but you don't really understand it until you're in front of someone who is not a musician. And it's your job to communicate and to capture their attention when they might even be a transient audience at a museum. So alongside that, we have a series of workshops, everything from marketing to fundraising to how to start your own business. Some of those are led by Fifth House. And then we also have a slate of guest experts who join us either in person or over Skype. So yesterday, for instance, we had James Falzone, who's a wonderful clarinetist and improviser, talking about improvisation as a way of life. Hmm. And then we also had James Buckhouse, who is formerly the director of corporate design at Twitter and now does story for Sequoia Capital, talking about how to build a story on social media.
Hmm. Wow. And I suppose all of the connections that Fifth House has made over the years bears wonderful fruit in terms of the people you're able to seek out and have be a part of Fresh Ink.
Absolutely. We've been really lucky to make a lot of great friends in a lot of places. And this two-week experience is, for us, the best of what we do. Like, we offer the best of what we do in these 2 weeks, and we also bring together our favorite people. And it's as much a learning experience for me as anything else. I mean, I'm getting my professional development time when our guest experts come in, too.
Sure. So these new compositions on the 5th of June, have they already been composed, these new pieces?
Yes. So they're being rehearsed now. So we're probably entering our cycle where we begin our second rehearsals on these pieces. I think everything has received a first rehearsal at this point in the festival. And what's really great is that it affords young composers the opportunity to work with a living, breathing ensemble of musicians to understand, okay, if I write it this way, what does it sound like? Or is there an easier way for me to notate this? And then also for musicians to have the opportunity to interact with a composer live in the room, as opposed to having to call them or email them or maybe talk through a Ouija board from the grave, you know.
Right.
it's a great experience.
How young are these composers?
So everyone's up to age 32, so we might have undergraduate all the way to postdoctorate.
Mm-hmm. And how did these 16 composers and these 16 pieces end up being the slate for this year's Fresh Ink? I mean, did people submit these, Or were they simply given the opportunity without the piece having yet been written?
We do have a competitive audition process for both instrumentalists, performers, and also for composers. So our composition faculty is Stacey Garup and Dan Visconti, and they get together for a weekend every year to go through all of the applications and to choose who our 16 composers are going to be. And then ultimately, we give them the challenge of writing for a very particular group of instruments. So we give them that instrumentation choice, I think, around March 15th or something like that. And they have to deliver a work by May 1st, so they don't have very long in order to get that done. But they are really tailor-making a piece for either a formed ensemble that's joining us here at the festival or for a grouping of instruments that is selected from participating instrumentalists that join us and members of Fifth House. So all of the groups that you'll see are sort of a mixture of faculty and participants.
Fantastic. So I know there are two performance opportunities that yet remain in this year's festival that people in the public could take advantage of. One of them is later today.
Yes, absolutely. So we will be at the Racine Public Library, the location on 7th Street, at 1:30 p.m., completely free admission, so please do join us. And then just as a note, we also will be on Thursday at the Racine Family YMCA, working with the kids there. And then lastly, one of the most exciting things we get to do is to actually premiere these works. So you'll hear half of them on June 19th, which is Sunday. We will be at Bedford Hall at the University of Wisconsin Parkside at 2 o'clock. Admission is free. There's a wine and hors d'oeuvres reception afterwards, so please do join us for that.
Fantastic. I know that you also want to mention something that, as we are recording this, has just become available to the public, namely Fifth House Ensemble's most recent recording called Nedudim. Tell us about that.
Sure. Nedudim is our second album that is being released on CD Records. It actually got released on June 10th. And it was an incredibly exciting project. We had support from the NEA and the MacArthur Foundation to do an international collaboration with an Israeli folk group. And the kind of music that they play is called Ladino music. So it's Jewish Sephardic music. So has influences from Spain and from countries throughout the Middle East. And so this album became an opportunity to explore the intersection of Mediterranean folk music and American folk music. At the same time, we also use this as an opportunity to think about what our earliest musical memories might be. So we gathered together organizations in Chicago representing Israel, Iran, Spain, and India. And we put everyone in the same room and asked them questions like, tell us about the first song you ever learned to sing. Or who taught you that song? Why was it significant? What did it mean? And, you know, those are cultural groups that sometimes, for political reasons, were very difficult to put into the same room.
Right.
But the ways that those questions got answered created such a common sense of like nostalgia and memory and a way of talking about culture that leveled the playing field in a certain kind of way. And so the conversations we had and the melodies that got sung back to us as part of that became part of the project and the album. So you'll see on there that there's an original song that we wrote together called Raga Etude that came from one of those conversations. And so the album is one-third Ladino folk music. It's one-third music by American composers like Dan Visconti, Ken Benshoof, and Robert Beeser that engage with American folk music. And we also, in the middle of that, have pieces that we wrote together. Which was really fun for us to explore improvisation and the process of creating music in a room together as opposed to receiving it on a page.
Wow. Sounds exciting. I look forward to hearing something from Nedudim, which means wanderer in Hebrew. In the meantime, several more opportunities are still on the calendar for people to enjoy some of these performances with the Fresh Ink Festival at UW Parkside today and Thursday, and a final concert on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And information about all this and more with Fifth House is available, I assume, on your beautiful website. What is that address again?
Absolutely. So information on Fifth House is at www.fifth-house.com. And the festival, more information is at www.freshinkfestival.com. And ink is spelled I-N-C.
I-N-C. Melissa Snow's executive director and flutist for Fifth House Ensemble. Melissa, it's always great to talk with you, and it's always so inspiring to hear about the exciting things that Fifth House Ensemble is doing. Best wishes to you and all your colleagues, and especially to all the young musicians participating in this year's Fresh Ink Festival.
Thank you so much.
Support for Classical. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, part one of my conversation with Wendy Paris, author of Splittopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well. On Thursday, part two of that program, we had some technical difficulties the last time we played this interview, and we're not able to share part two of the conversation with you. So we'll finally get around to that on Thursday's program. And we'll also play for you a very interesting new interview with Trevor Cromoulinot, author of Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18, a very, very interesting book. And be sure to mark your calendar for Friday's morning show, especially if you're a baseball fan, when I speak with Handsome Ransom Jackson, 90 years old, looking back on his professional
org.
Support for WPR comes from the UW Health Breast Center, offering
when he looks back on his professional baseball career from the 1950s. His career included playing both against and with the legendary Jackie Robinson, along with other luminaries from that era. He's written a wonderful memoir called Handsome Ransom Jackson, An Accidental Big Leaguer. And you'll hear my conversation with him on Friday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you'll find the program archived on